listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the November 2019 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair Part B. Once upon a time in Burbank, a $7 billion deal with Steve Jobs and Pixar ushered in a new era of prosperity for Disney. In an exclusive from his new book, CEO Bob Iger opens up about how an unlikely friendship made magic. Opening photo, Double Vision. Bob Iger and Steve Jobs in 2006, 8 months after the Disney-Pixar deal. "Look what we did," Jobs later said. "We saved two companies." This article is adapted from The Ride of a Lifetime, Lessons Learned from 15 Years as CEO of the Walt Disney Company by Robert Iger, published September 23, 2019 by Random House, a division of Penguin Random House, LLC. Copyright 2019 by Robert Iger. In January 2006, I joined Steve Jobs in Emeryville, California, to announce Disney's acquisition of Pixar, the acclaimed animation studio chaired by Steve. I had become CEO of Disney just 3 months prior, and the deal represented an enormous opportunity and risk for the company and me personally. The plan that day was to release the announcement after the stock market closed at 1 p.m. Pacific time, then hold a press conference and a town hall meeting with Pixar's employees. Just after noon, Steve pulled me aside. "Let's take a walk," he said. I knew Steve liked to go on long walks, frequently with friends or colleagues, but I was surprised at the timing and suspicious about his request. I wondered whether he wanted to back out of the deal or renegotiate its terms. I looked at my watch. It was 12:15. We walked for a while and then sat on a bench in the middle of Pixar's beautiful manicured grounds. Steve put his arm behind me, which was a nice, unexpected gesture. He said, "I'm going to tell you something that only Laureen, his wife, and my doctors know." He asked me for complete confidentiality, and then he told me that his cancer had returned. "Steve," I said, "why are you telling me this now?" "I am about to become your biggest shareholder and a member of your board," he said, "and I think I owe you the right, given this knowledge, to back out of the deal." It was 12:30, only 30 minutes before we were to announce. I wasn't sure how to respond, and I was struggling to process what I'd just been told, which included asking myself whether what I now knew would trigger any disclosure obligations. He wanted complete confidentiality, so it would be impossible to do anything except accept his offer and back away from a deal I wanted badly and we needed badly. Finally, I said, "Steve, in less than 30 minutes, we are set to announce a $7+ billion deal. What would I tell our board? That I got cold feet?" He told me to blame him. I then asked, "Is there more that I need to know about this? Help me make this decision." He told me the cancer was now in his liver, and he talked about the odds of beating it. He was going to do whatever it took to be at his son Reed's high school graduation, he said. When he told me that was 4 years away, I felt devastated. It was impossible to be having these two conversations, about Steve facing his impending death and about the deal we were supposed to be closing in minutes, at the same time. I decided to reject his offer. Even if I took him up on it, I wouldn't have been able to explain why to our board, which not only had approved it, but had endured months of my pleas to do so. It was now 10 minutes before our release was to go out. I had no idea if I was doing the right thing, but I'd quickly calculated that Steve was not material to the deal itself, although he certainly was material to me. We walked in silence back to the atrium. That night, I took my wife, Willow Bay, into my confidence. Willow had known Steve for years, since long before I knew him, and instead of toasting what had been a momentous day in my early tenure as CEO, we cried together over the news. No matter what he told me, no matter how resolved he would be in his fight with cancer, we dreaded what was ahead for him. That Steve and I were standing on that stage together at all was something of a miracle. Before I became CEO, Disney's relationship with Pixar and Steve was in tatters. In the 90s, Disney struck a deal to co-produce, market, and distribute Pixar's films, starting with the enormously successful Toy Story, the world's first full-length, digitally animated feature. Toy Story represented a seismic creative and technological leap, and it grossed nearly $400 million worldwide. It was followed by A Bug's Life in 1998 and Monsters, Inc. in 2001. Taken together, those three movies grossed well over $1 billion worldwide and established Pixar at a time when Disney animation was beginning to falter as the future of animation. Over the next 10 years, Disney released 5 additional Pixar films, including the hugely successful Finding Nemo and The Incredibles. But the relationship between Steve and my predecessor, Michael Eisner, started to falter. Attempts to renegotiate the terms of the deal or to extend the relationship met with failure, frustration, and rancor, and in January 2004, Steve made a very public, in-your-face announcement that he would never deal with Disney again. The end of the Pixar partnership was a huge blow from both a financial and a public relations standpoint. Steve was one of the most respected people in the world, and his rejection and withering criticism of Disney had been so public that any mending of that fence would be seen as a big early win for me as Disney's brand new CEO. Plus, Pixar was now the standard bearer in animation, and while I didn't yet have a complete sense of just how broken Disney animation was, I knew that any renewed partnership would be good for our business. I also knew that chances were slim that someone as headstrong as Steve would be open to something, but I had to try. I called Steve when it was announced I would succeed Michael as CEO, and while the call was hardly an icebreaker, we agreed to talk down the road. 2 months later, I reached out again. My ultimate goal was to somehow make things right with Pixar, but I couldn't ask for that initially. Steve's animosity toward Disney was too deep-rooted. I had an unrelated idea, though, that I thought might interest him. I told him I was a huge music lover and that I had all of my music stored on my iPod, which I used constantly. I'd been thinking about the future of television and believed it was only a matter of time before we would be accessing TV shows and movies on our computers. I didn't know how fast mobile technology was going to evolve. The iPhone was still 2 years away, so what I was imagining was an iTunes platform for television, ITV as I described it. Steve was silent for a while, and then finally said, "I'm going to come back to you on this. I'm working on something I want to show you." A few weeks later, he flew down to Burbank. You can't tell anyone about this, he said, but what you're talking about with television shows, that's exactly what we've been imagining. He slowly withdrew a device from his pocket. This is our new video iPod, he said. It had a screen the size of a couple of postage stamps, but he was talking about it like it was an IMAX theater. This is going to allow people to watch video on our iPods, not just listen to music, he said. If we bring this product to market, will you put your television shows on it? I said yes, right away. Steve responded to boldness. Among his many frustrations was a feeling that it was often too difficult to get anything done with Disney. Every agreement needed to be vetted and analyzed to within an inch of its life, and that's not how he worked. I wanted him to understand that I didn't work that way either, that I was empowered to make a call, and that I was eager to figure out this future together and to do so quickly. That October, 5 months after that first conversation, and 2 weeks after I officially became CEO, Steve and I stood on stage together at the Apple launch and announced that 5 Disney shows, including 2 of the most popular on TV, Desperate Housewives and Lost, would now be available for download on iTunes and for consumption on the new iPod. The ease and the speed with which we got the deal done, combined with the fact that it showed an admiration for Apple and its products, blew Steve's mind. He told me he'd never met anyone in the entertainment business who was willing to try something that might disrupt his own company's business model. Those months spent talking with Steve began, slowly, tentatively, to open up into discussions of a possible new Pixar deal. Steve had softened, but only a little. He was willing to talk, but his version of any new agreement was still very one-sided in Pixar's favor. The reality was, Steve had all of the leverage in the world. He never seemed worried about walking away. It was around this time that I had a radical idea. Disney should buy Pixar. In my first board meeting as CEO, I explained that it was imperative for me to figure out how to turn Disney Animation around. Throughout the late 80s and early 90s, the division had produced hit after hit. The Little Mermaid, Beauty and the Beast, Aladdin, and The Lion King. But then, amidst a number of high-profile management conflicts, the unit began to falter. The next several years would be dotted by a slew of expensive failures. Hercules, Atlantis, Treasure Planet, Fantasia 2000, Brother Bear, Home on the Range, and Chicken Little. Others, The Hunchback of Notre Dame, Mulan, Tarzan, and Lilo and Stitch, were modest successes, but none came close to the creative or commercial successes of the prior decade. I saw 3 possible paths forward. The first was to stick with current management. The second was to identify new talent, but I'd scoured the animation and movie-making world looking for people who could do the job at the level we needed, and I'd come up empty. Or we could buy Pixar, which would bring John Lasseter and Ed Catmull, Pixar's visionary leaders, along with Steve Jobs, into Disney. The board was somewhat incredulous when I raised this idea at the very beginning of my tenure as CEO, but they were intrigued enough to allow me to explore it, perhaps because it seemed so far-fetched. About a week and a half before our announcement about the video iPod, I summoned the courage to call Steve and say, "I have another crazy idea. Can I come see you in a day or two to discuss it?" I didn't yet fully appreciate just how much Steve liked radical ideas. "Tell me now," he said. I thought Steve would likely say no immediately. He might also be offended at what he perceived as the arrogance of the idea. Even if he told me where I could shove it, though, I'd be left exactly where I already was. I had nothing to lose. "I've been thinking about our respective futures," I said. "What do you think about the idea of Disney buying Pixar?" I waited for him to hang up or to erupt in laughter. The quiet before his response seemed endless. Instead, he said, "You know, that's not the craziest idea in the world." A couple of weeks later, Steve and I met in Apple's boardroom in Cupertino, California. It was a long room, with a table nearly as long down the middle. One wall was glass, looking out over the entrance to Apple's campus, and the other featured a whiteboard, probably 25 feet long. Steve said he loved whiteboard exercises, where an entire vision, all the thoughts and designs and calculations, could be drawn out at the whim of whoever held the felt pen. Not unexpectedly, Steve was the holder of the pen, and I sensed he was quite used to assuming that role. He stood with marker in hand and scrawled pros on one side and cons on the other. I was too nervous to launch in, so I ceded the first serve to him. "Okay," he said. "Well, I've got some cons." He wrote the first with gusto. "Disney's culture will destroy Pixar." I couldn't blame him for that. His experience with Disney so far hadn't provided any evidence to the contrary. He went on, writing his cons in full sentences across the board. "Fixing Disney animation will take too long and will burn John and Ed out in the process. There's too much ill will, and the healing will take years. Wall Street will hate it. Your board will never let you do it." There were many more, but one in all cap letters: "Distraction will kill Pixar's creativity." I assumed he meant that the whole process of a deal and the assimilation would be too much of a shock to the system they'd created. It seemed pointless for me to add to his list, so we moved to the pros. I went first and said, "Disney will be saved by Pixar, and we'll all live happily ever after." Steve smiled, but didn't write it down. "What do you mean?" I said. "Turning animation around and will totally change the perception of Disney and shift our fortunes. Plus, John and Ed will have a much larger canvas to paint on." 2 hours later, the pros were meager and the cons were abundant, even if a few of them, in my estimation, were quite petty. I felt dispirited, but I should have expected this. "Well," I said, "it was a nice idea, but I don't see how we do this." "A few solid pros are more powerful than dozens of cons," Steve said. "So what should we do next?" We agreed I needed to learn more about Pixar and to see it firsthand. Next photos, Blood Brothers. Jobs and Iger announced their first of many deals, 2005. Man of Characters, Iger at Toy Story 3's world premiere in Hollywood, 2010. Fun and Frames, director John Lasseter and Jobs at Pixar, 1997. If I had to name the 10 best days I've ever had on the job, that first visit would be high on the list. What I saw that day left me breathless. The level of talent and creativity and creative ambition, the commitment to quality, the storytelling ingenuity, the technology, the leadership structure, and the air of enthusiastic collaboration, even the building, the architecture itself. It was a culture that anyone in a creative business, in any business, would aspire to, and it was so far beyond where Disney Animation was, and beyond anything we might be able to achieve on our own, that I felt we had to do all we could to make this happen. When I got back to my office in Burbank, I met immediately with my team. It's an understatement to say they didn't share my enthusiasm. There were too many risks, they said. The cost would be too great. Many people thought Steve would be impossible to deal with and would try to run the company. They worried that I was barely into my tenure as CEO, and I was already putting my future, not to mention the company's future, on the line by pursuing this. But my instinct about Pixar was powerful. I believed this acquisition could transform us. It could fix Disney Animation. It could add Steve Jobs, arguably the strongest possible voice on issues of technology, to the Disney board. It could bring a culture of excellence and ambition into ours that would reverberate in much-needed ways throughout the company. Not long after, I flew to San Jose and met with Steve at Apple's headquarters. I knew going in that I didn't want the process to be drawn out. Steve was constitutionally incapable of a long, complicated back and forth, and I feared that if we got bogged down on any one point, he would sour on the whole thing and walk away. So as soon as we sat down, I said, "I'll be straight with you. This is something I feel we have to do." Steve agreed. But unlike in the past, he didn't use his leverage to demand a wildly impossible number. Wherever we landed was going to be very good for them, but he knew it needed to be in the realm of possibility for us too, and I think he appreciated my frankness. Over the course of the next month, we went over the possible financial structure in great detail and arrived at a price, $7.4 billion. Even if Steve stopped just short of being greedy, it was still a huge price, and it was going to be a tough sell to our board and to investors. I realized my best shot was for the board to hear from Steve, John, and Ed directly. So, on a weekend in January 2006, we all convened in a Goldman Sachs conference room in L.A. Several members of the board were still opposed. But the moment the Pixar team started talking, everyone in the room was transfixed. They had no notes, no decks, no visual aids. They just talked about Pixar's philosophy and how they worked, about what we were already dreaming of doing together, and about who they were as people. As for Steve, it's hard to imagine a better salesman for something this ambitious. He talked about the need for big companies to take risk. He talked about where Disney had been and what it needed to do to radically change course. He talked about me and the bond that we'd formed already with the iTunes deal, but also in our ongoing discussions about preserving Pixar's culture and his desire to work together to make this crazy idea a success. For the first time, watching him speak, I felt optimistic that it might happen. The board was scheduled to meet for a final vote on January 24th, but word of a possible deal soon leaked. Suddenly, I was receiving calls from people urging me not to do it. But my confidence never wavered. I was on a mission as I addressed the board and spoke with as much fire as I could muster. "The future of the company is right here, right now," I said. "It's in your hands." I repeated something I'd said back in October in my first board meeting as CEO. "As Disney Animation goes, so goes the company." It was true in 1937 with Snow White and the Seven Dwarves, and in 1994 with The Lion King, and it's no less true right now. When animation soars, Disney soars. We have to do this. Our path to the future starts right here, tonight. When I was done, the room went very quiet, and a vote was taken. After all the board had been through over the past few years, it seemed likely that risk aversion could rule the day. The first four members voted yes, and the fifth also voted yes, but added that he was doing so only out of support for me. Of the remaining five, two voted against, bringing the final tally to 9-4 and 2 against. The deal was approved, and the fortunes of the company began to improve almost right before our eyes. Steve became a Disney board member and our largest shareholder, and whenever I wanted to do something big, I talked it over with him. In 2009, after our very successful acquisition of Pixar, we were interested in acquiring Marvel. So I met with Steve and walked him through the business. He claimed to have never read a comic book in his life. "I hate them more than I hate video games," he told me. So I brought an encyclopedia of Marvel characters with me to explain the universe to him and show him what we would be buying. He spent about 10 seconds looking at it, then pushed it aside and said, "Is this one important to you? Do you really want it? Is it another Pixar?" Steve and I had become good friends since we'd made the Pixar deal. We socialized on occasion and talked a few times a week. We vacationed at adjacent Hawaiian hotels a few times and would meet and take long walks on the beach, talking about our wives and kids, about music, about Apple and Disney, and the things we might still do together. Our connection was much more than a business relationship. We enjoyed each other's company immensely, and we felt we could say anything to each other, that our friendship was strong enough that it was never threatened by candor. You don't expect to develop such close friendships late in life, but when I think back on my time as CEO, and the things I'm most grateful for and surprised by, my relationship with Steve is one of them. He could criticize me, and I could disagree, and neither of us took it too personally. Plenty of people warned me that the worst thing I could do was let Steve into the company, that he would bully me and everyone else. I always said the same thing. How can Steve Jobs coming into our company not be a good thing? Even if it comes at my expense. Who wouldn't want Steve Jobs to have influence over how a company is run? I wasn't worried about how he would act, and I was confident that if he did do something that was out of line, I could call him out on it. He was quick to judge people, and when he criticized, it was often quite harsh. That said, he came to all the board meetings and actively participated, giving the kind of objective criticism you'd expect from any board member. He rarely created trouble for me. Not never, but rarely. When it came to the Marvel question, I told him that I wasn't sure if it was another Pixar, but that they had great talent at the company, and the content was so rich that if we held the IP, it would put some real distance between us and everyone else. I asked him if he'd be willing to reach out to Ike Perlmutter. Marvel's CEO and controlling shareholder, and vouch for me. Later, after we'd closed the deal, Ike told me that he'd still had his doubts, and the call from Steve made a big difference. "He said you were true to your word," Ike said. I was grateful that Steve was willing to do it as a friend, really, more than as the most influential member of our board. Every once in a while, I would say to him, "I have to ask you this. You're our largest shareholder." And he would always respond, "You can't think of me as that. That's insulting. I'm just a good friend." With every success the company has had since Steve's death, there's always a moment in the midst of my excitement when I think, "I wish Steve could be here for this." It's impossible not to have the conversation with him in my head that I wish I could be having in real life. More than that, I believe that if Steve were still alive, we would have combined our companies, or at least discussed the possibility very seriously. In the summer of 2011, Steve and Laureen came to our house in L.A. to have dinner with Willow and me. He was in the late stages of cancer by then, terribly thin and in obvious pain. He had very little energy, and his voice was a low rasp. But he wanted to spend an evening with us, in part to toast what we'd done years ago. We sat in our dining room and raised glasses of wine before dinner. "Look what we did," he said. "We saved two companies." All four of us teared up. This was Steve at his warmest and most sincere. He was convinced that Pixar had flourished in ways that it never would have had it not become part of Disney, and that Disney had been re-energized by bringing on Pixar. I couldn't help but think of those early conversations and how nervous I was to reach out to him. It was only 6 years before, but it seemed like another lifetime. He'd become so important to me, professionally and personally. As we toasted, I could barely look at Willow. She had known Steve much longer than I had, going way back to 1982, when he was one of the young, brash, brilliant founders of Apple. Now, he was gaunt and frail and in the last months of his life, and I knew how much it pained her to see him that way. He died on October 5, 2011. There were about 25 people at his burial in Palo Alto. We gathered in a tight square around his coffin, and Laureen asked if anyone wanted to say anything. I hadn't prepared to speak, but the memory of that walk we took on Pixar's campus years earlier came to mind. I'd never told anyone other than Alan Braverman, our general counsel, and Willow, because I needed to share the emotional intensity of that day. I thought the moment captured Steve's character, though, so I recalled it there at the cemetery. Steve pulling me aside, the walk across campus, the way he put his arm around me and delivered the news, his concern that I should have this intimate, terrible knowledge, because it might affect me and Disney, and he wanted to be fully transparent. The emotion with which he talked about his son and his need to live long enough to see him graduate from high school and begin his life as an adult. After the funeral, Laureen came up to me and said, "I've never told my side of that story." She described Steve coming home that night. We had dinner, and then the kids left the dinner table, and I said to Steve, "So, did you tell him?" "I told him." And I said, "Can we trust him?" We were standing there with Steve's grave behind us, and Laureen, who just buried her husband, gave me a gift that I've thought about nearly every day since. I've certainly thought of Steve every day. "I asked him if we could trust you," Laureen said, and Steve said, "I love that guy." The feeling was mutual.
Thank you.
face value. Founder and CEO Emily Weiss has taken Glossier from millennial catnip to billion-dollar juggernaut. 5 years in, Marissa Meltzer goes deep on the beauty brand's boom. Photographs by Martin Scheller, styled by Anatoly Smith. Opening photo, owning it, Emily Weiss, photographed at Glossier's flagship store in New York City. America met Emily Weiss in 2007, halfway into the second season of MTV's The Hills. As the camera panned up from a pair of high heels, we saw a college-age Weiss striding through a Los Angeles office, dressed in a short flared skirt and a black turtleneck. Emily, New York intern, flashed on the screen. With her pin-straight brown hair and a binder in hand, she looked like some wildly confident apparition who had come to show the laconic stars of the series what working at a magazine really takes. In this case, efficiently map-questing directions and discussing chinoiserie with nonchalant authority, they called her with begrudging awe the super intern. 12 years later, Weiss is the CEO of Glossier, the paradigm-shifting beauty brand she founded in 2014, and she still has the same command, as seen on an early summer morning in Manhattan. At the company's Soho headquarters, a meeting of the in-house brain trust has convened in a tiny conference room. Weiss deemed a larger one too cold to review plans for an upcoming pop-up store in Boston, open through October 6th. "Did I show you guys the tweet?" Weiss asked brightly, taking out her iPhone for show and tell. "This is the line outside Glossier Seattle on the last weekend. It's a full city block long." Weiss pauses over renderings of the section devoted to their lipstick, Generation G. It's a sheer formula, the kind you can swipe on in the back of a Lyft or midway through a Hinge date. You could be 15, or you could be like 60, but if you believe what we believe, then you're a part of Generation G, she says. We can really own that here. Maybe we can add some text, suggests Adriana DeLeo, the head of design. Yeah, that's a good idea, Weiss agrees, tapping her fingers on her mouth. Instead of "you look good," the tagline already emblazoned across the company's mirrors, maybe it's "I'm Generation G," creative director Marie Suter answers, sipping a ginger ale with a paper straw. Weiss nods. Weiss has on a loose floral dress and Birkenstock lookalikes. Her low-key ethos could be mistaken for that of a hoodie-sporting tech bro, but a close observer will notice that those sandals are Chanel. Despite heading a beauty company, Weiss, 34, appears practically barefaced. In early hashtag parlance, she hashtag woke up like this. That's the prevailing Glossier aesthetic, one admittedly best suited to the age group that needs no cosmetic help at all. But making things look convincingly effortless in business or in makeup is a special feat. Weiss's brushed-up arches are no doubt held in place by the cult pomade Boy Brow. The $16 product debuted in 2016 with a 10,000-person wait list. Her skin's fresh from the sauna glow suggest a cocktail of the vitamin-boosted Super Pack serums, a trio priced at the relative bargain of $65. And her cheeks, dabbed with rosy cloud paint perhaps, telegraph the kind of flush that follows a light jog, or a $1.2 billion valuation. That is what has catapulted Glossier, pronounced like dossier, into the pantheon of unicorns, the tech-speak term for startups worth a cool 10 figures. Never mind that it's also an apt description for pastel packaging bedecked with the occasional hologram. In the $500 billion global beauty industry, one that's anecdotally recession-proof as the economy seems to teeter, Glossier is hardly the only power player with a name that still goes unrecognized in more analog corners of the country. It might be tempting to align Weiss with the pioneers of yore, Estée Lauder, Mary Kay Ash, or the bold-faced bosses of today, Fenty's Rihanna, Kylie Jenner. But Weiss fits best among a cohort of millennial founders, including Audrey Gelman of the women's co-working space and social club The Wing, and outdoor voices Ty Haney, whose real-world savvy and third-wave feminist bent grant them a gods among women stature. The message is understood. With the right work ethic and brow grooming, you can have it all. In some sense, Glossier devotees can have it all, with a slogan that reads like a breezy to-do list: skin first, makeup second, smile always, and pricing that falls between drugstore and concept shop. The brand doesn't need sticker shock to make a status object. One of its early signatures, the pink bubble mailer, elevated ho-hum shipping supplies to marketing genius. You can spot them repurposed as toiletry cases and airport X-ray bins. Glossier even gave the name Bubble Wrap to its recent eye and lip formula with a matching pink cap. This kind of in-crowd sensibility brought in a million new customers last year to the tune of $100 million plus in revenue. As the financial market has taken notice, so have the next-level fans. In July, Michelle Obama showed up at Essence Festival in New Orleans, her lips glistening in a soon-to-launch shade of Glossier lip gloss. Later that week, some members of the U.S. women's soccer team stopped by the Manhattan flagship the day before their ticker tape parade. It's only a matter of time before Ruth Bader Ginsburg hits the bench with a slick of haloscope shimmering across her cheekbones. Next photo, Generation G. Weiss with the store's offline editors, Ernest Brockenberry, Allie Walsh, Sean Fitzgibbons, Maggie Dunleavy, Jaitra Raju, and Angie Petra. Born to an executive father and a stay-at-home mom, Weiss grew up mostly in a small enclave of Connecticut, a precocious fashion obsessive in a land of lacrosse players and manicured lawns. The first step toward her future life was, fittingly, a glossy Condé Nast Teen Vogue, where she super-interned during college. "When I bring up the hills," Weiss groans, and I don't blame her. "I, too, would cringe at being associated with a reality show best known for mascara tears and an alleged object of desire named Justin Bobby." Out of the gate, Weiss proved to be indefatigable, balancing a full course load at New York University and part-time work at Chanel with her magazine duties, behind the scenes and often in the pages. To Teen Vogue readers, she was the pretty brunette who wore a vintage dress to prom. To Ava Chen, at the time an editor in the beauty department and now Instagram's director of fashion partnerships, Weiss had that X factor. She was a college student who clearly had a plan, so pulled together and focused, which was so different from me at that age. High praise from Chin, herself an early bloomer who was tapped to edit Lucky at 33. By the summer of 2010, Weiss, then a fashion assistant at Vogue, was relaxing on a Connecticut beach with her family when she dreamed up a beauty blog called Into the Gloss. Back at the office, in search of a sounding board, She asked Chin if she could have a word. She closed the door, and I was like, oh, this is serious, Chin recalls. Weiss wanted to start a website that would show the real-world beauty routines of fashion insiders and celebrities, stuff that she learned on shoots, like Carly Kloss's devotion to bag balm ointment on her lips. Weiss bought a $750 used camera and the domain for IntoTheGloss.com, and by September, the first post went live, with publicist Nikki Deem sharing her Fashion Week survival items. The site's top shelf column gained an immediate following. In it, a famous, or at least cool person, chronicles their grooming routine in sprawling detail, striking a tone that feels voyeuristic, useful, and democratic. Jenna Lyons may have had a makeup artist friend bring her back Can Make Cream Cheek from Japan, but she also praised Blistex Medicated Lip Balm. This summer, before her best-selling essay collection debuted, Gia Tolentino mock-cursed Tatcha's cleansing oil in her top shelf. It's so nice, and it's so expensive. Kill me. By early 2012, the site had more than 200,000 unique visitors per month. By May 2016, that number had swelled to 1.3 million. Next photo, reflecting well, Weiss in the Instagram-ready showroom. I got a master's in the state of beauty through Into the Gloss, Weiss says, describing all the weird hang-ups people have about beauty and the double standards. She has spent a lot of time reflecting on its broader role, how beauty can start conversations, how beauty can break down walls, and how beauty is something that every single person everywhere in the world deals with. It's really fundamental to who you are and how you relate. In 2012, she tapped former Elle staffer Nick Axelrod to be the site's editorial director, anchoring its place in the crowded new media landscape. Axelrod split with the company shortly before Glossier launched. He demurred when asked to comment, but then again, he's busy with his own Instabate body care line, Necessaire. Weiss had plenty of fashion types on board, but she soon learned that Into the Gloss was an all-access pass to powerful people. I could not only meet Arianna Huffington, but go into her bathroom, spend 2 hours with her, and in turn make her feel really seen and heard, because she reads the article that I painstakingly edited from 4 a.m. to 8 a.m. More than that, as Into the Gloss drew an avid readership, it also amassed potential customers. Beauty obsessives who were all too willing to discuss what kind of products they longed for. In other words, prime market research. Weiss noticed that the beauty conglomerates had a top-down way of communicating via celebrity ads or department store placements. She knew from the flood of comments on social media that her largely millennial fans preferred a more conversational approach. Before the phrase direct-to-consumer rolled off the tongue, that's exactly what Weiss had in mind. It was far from easy to secure funding. After nearly a dozen rejections, Weiss raised $2 million for her new project in 2013, led by Kirsten Green at Forerunner Ventures in San Francisco. 9 months later, after 125 teaser posts on Instagram, she launched Glossier with four universal products: moisturizer, facial spray, sheer foundation, and a lip and skin salve called Balm.com. The way I was thinking about it is, how do you make an entire beauty company based on acknowledging that everyone is their own expert? You have an opinion about beauty that actually someone else will probably benefit from, Weiss says. The fact of the matter is, the majority of women today make a beauty purchasing decision based on a stranger on the internet's content. She stops short of taking any credit, but I catch a hint of a knowing smile. In July, Weiss invites me to her Soho apartment to make a frittata. The message is relayed via one of her publicists, an omnipresent retinue that always seems to hover within reach, guarding the company narrative. It's the first time, I am told, that a journalist has seen where she lives. I arrive a few minutes before our appointment on a Friday afternoon, and her doorman, make that super doorman, waits until the precise time to let me onto the elevator. Weiss greets me with a hug, wearing an oversized blouse, a knee-length skirt, and slippers. Her assistant, Stacy, is answering email at a long table festooned with the same sculptural floral arrangements found at the company headquarters. There is no publicist. From the windows of Weiss's living room, you can see the Glossier office. That doesn't bode well for work-life balance, but she swears the proximity allows her to sleep in. She's not a morning person, and walk to work. It's a rental apartment, heavy on natural light, with the same white, pink, and red palette as one of her thronged pop-ups. In the bedroom, laundry is air-drying on a rack in the corner. Over her low-slung bed, there's a Glossier photograph of lips that looks like a Marilyn Minter. Outside in the living room, there's a real Marilyn Minter, a painting of a woman's face behind steamed-up glass. Weiss shows me the tiny guest room where she has painted the lower half of the walls a shade of buttery yellow in homage to Chef Friedrich Bilbray's Apollo Bar in Copenhagen. The long table is where Weiss likes to have people over for brunch, mostly bagels she picks up from the old-school delicatessen Russ and Daughters. I did try keto, but it made me feel kind of dead inside. She tells me she has basically five friends who met in Florence while studying abroad. Even when you're a student, it's still such a rat race as soon as you get to the city. Every single person who comes here is like, I'm a tiny adult. I want to work and get an internship. Including me, she acknowledges. Weiss doesn't cook a whole lot, but today we are making a salmon and goat cheese frittata from an Ina Garten recipe. This article will be continued in the next installment. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both Parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selection by Mark Hoffman.